You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today.
It's a very mathematical idea, the idea that a donut and a coffee mug are topologically identical. And it's a really strange idea to think that that means that those two things must have similar behaviors in certain instances, right?
We complete our rundown of this year's biggest stories in physics, including...
which was this way to allegedly break time symmetry by sort of oscillating indefinitely without any energy input. Doctor Who immediately comes to mind.
And...
it's a totally different way of observing the universe. It opens up a totally new type of astronomy.
I'm Zia Morali. Welcome to the third and final part of FQXI's countdown of the top five physics stories of 2017. Once again, I'm joined by Ian Durham, a quantum physicist at St. Anselm's College in New Hampshire and an FQXI member, who has compiled his list of favourites. On our last edition, we discussed the items that took the fifth and fourth placed spots on Ian's list. The first demonstration of particle-free quantum communication and interstellar object Oumuamua's visit to our solar system. Just before we pick up the conversation again, I will warn you that in a couple of places our Skype connection gets a bit hairy for a few seconds, but please keep listening because the sound quality rapidly recovers. So now, back over to Ian for the research feat that makes it to number three on the list.
Number three gives me the opportunity to talk once again about topology. So this guy at UC San Diego, Boubacar Kanté, he basically came up with the idea of developing a topological laser cavity. So what is that? So the way lasers work, and the light bounces around inside what's called an optical cavity before getting lased out. You need the light to bounce back and forth a certain number of times in order for it to actually amplify the signal. And in most laser cavities, the laser cavity itself is actually shaped like a ring. And the reason it's shaped like a ring is because you don't want any sharp corners because you can't lose any of the photons. When you shape it like a ring, it's nice because any photon that maybe goes slightly off track will bounce in such a way that it'll keep it inside the cavity, right? It's nice and compact. Why couldn't we just have regular old lasers? What's wrong with regular old lasers? Well, we use lasers in everything nowadays. I mean, we've been using lasers for decades, and you go to the store and you buy something at the supermarket and you scan, it's a laser. And so they're doing optical stuff at this level. So if you try to put a bunch of rings together on a chip, you get a lot of empty, wasted space in between the rings, right?
Right, yeah.
So what these guys did, what Kanté and his group did, is they created what's called a topological cavity.
Okay, so they've made a topological laser cavity, and topology is a really mathematical concept. So can you just tell us a bit more about what topology actually is? What does it mean?
This is the analogy I like to give. A donut and a cup of coffee are topologically equivalent because they both have one hole in them. Another way of putting it is if the donut were made out of something gooey, right?
Like donut stuff.
Yeah, donut.
Donuts, yeah.
But held together a little bit more than a donut, right?
Yeah.
You could reshape it into a coffee mug shape without changing its fundamental structure, right?
Right, so you don't have to like kind of puncture another hole in it to get a coffee cup.
Right.
You can just kind of squash it and reshape it.
Yeah. So a donut and a coffee mug are topologically equivalent. That's what topology is all about.
And now, how did the group at UC San Diego use this idea to build a better laser cavity?
What they did is they used these things called photonic crystals, which are made from yttrium iron garnet. And what a photonic crystal does is it has a crystal structure that is on the same exact size scale as the wavelength of light passing through it. So if you have a crystal where you have an atom, then you have another atom evenly spaced all the way along. The spacing between the atoms is on the order of the wavelength of the light that you're sending through it. And the structure then can act as a mirror in that way. And so it steers light along a desired path. So you can have a curved type of shape and it'll go through that shape.
you might be getting to this, or you might have said it already, and I kind of didn't quite get it, but where does the sort of topology aspect come into it in terms of being able to steer the light?
So they had to come up with a way to figure out if there was a way to create a cavity that was topologically equivalent, but was a different shape. What they did is they made two types of photonic crystals. So one had it was star-shaped, and it was set in a square lattice. And then they had a triangular shape with cylindrical air holes. And the guy, Conte, compared the different crystals to a bagel and a pretzel, though they're both essentially bread with a hole. Although a pretzel really has more than one hole. So technically a pretzel is not topologically equivalent to a bagel. Anyway, in his system, one crystal sits inside a different crystal, and the interface where the two meet becomes the cavity. So what he's got is he's got two shapes. They're actually topologically equivalent, but of different shapes. And so they're topologically the same, but it allows you to have a uniquely shaped cavity, right? It doesn't have to be a sphere or a ring, which is a very symmetric shape, right? The whole point is to come up with ways of making a cavity where the shape doesn't have to be pretty and symmetric.
But it's the equivalent of being pretty and symmetric. It gives you the benefits of it without being exactly. It. I see. I get you.
Yes, you get the benefits of being pretty and symmetric without being pretty and symmetric.
Wow.
It's a really subtle concept. You don't get any losses with the photons because of the topological equivalency of the two surfaces, right?
No, it's a great one. You know, if you told me ahead of time, you did tell me ahead of time, but if you told me, you know, way back that this year one of the top stories was going to be building a better laser cavity, you know, on our list of sort of foundational physics stories of the year, it doesn't sound that exciting, but actually, I mean, it is such a very clever technique. You know, using this really kind of weird theoretical thing and then, you know, just getting it into such a sort of practical use, that's kind of beautiful.
It's very beautiful. While it has certainly had a practical implication, it's really foundational because, God, you're using, I mean, topological equivalency is a really pure mathy kind of thing, right? It's a very mathematical idea, the idea that a donut and a coffee mug are topologically identical. And it's a really strange idea to think that that means that those two things must have similar behaviors in certain instances, right? And because of that, they can behave in such a way where you get some really amazing stuff going on. But it's due to really sort of like this pure math kind of idea.
It's making me think of one of my friends who's a pure mathematician, and she hates these kinds of stories because she finds them, you know, they sort of sully pure mathematics for her. Whenever she finds out that there might be some kind of practical use for something that she studies, it upsets her. It just feels really, really wrong to her.
That's funny. I think all math applies to something.
Okay, right. So from that sort of digression to the second top story of 2017.
So this has to do with time. And I do a lot of work on time. I'm writing a book on time. I teach an entire class entirely on the nature of time. So about 5 years ago, Frank Wilczek, who is also, I believe he's an FQXI board member. Like, isn't he on the board, I think?
He probably is. Yeah.
Yes. So Frank came up with this idea of this theoretical thing that he called a time crystal, which was this way to allegedly break time symmetry by sort of oscillating indefinitely without any energy input.
See, it already sounds amazing, though. Without you don't have to say anything else. Time crystal that breaks time symmetry.
So I know. Doctor Who immediately comes to mind.
So I think before we get to how to do it, maybe we should say a little bit more about what it means. Because he has this analogy where he talks about sort of, I guess, symmetry in space. Yes. And he talks about crystals, like the crystals that we kind of know about. And, you know, to kind of talk about it in terms of time is already a little bit confusing. So maybe if we can talk about it in terms of space.
I have this problem when I try to talk about it with my students. So this is Frank's analogy. He uses a highly ordered lattice structure.
It's an analogy to a physical lattice. So the lattices that we think of as diamond and salt are lattices just in space. And empty space exhibits a symmetry such that no point is any different than any other, right? This is a fundamental thing in relativity, in fact. It's that point in space itself doesn't have any effect on the object. Well, crystals actually break the symmetry since their constituent atoms sit at very well-defined locations, right? So you're breaking that symmetry because I can say you are in London and I'm in Kennebunk. And so that's technically breaking that symmetry of saying that no point in space is better than any other point in space. I shouldn't say better. Better is not a good word. London and Kennebunk are equivalent in the good category.
Of course, yes, yes.
Anyway, so it's basically this idea of a spontaneous repeating structure, right? So that's what a lattice is. So Wilczek came up with this idea. What if we could have systems of particles that actually form these repeating structures, but not in space, but actually in time? And so he had this idea of applying a static magnetic field across a ring of quantum particles. The particles would then group together in clumps around the ring, and then they would rotate. And they would just sort of have this perpetual oscillation, which if you were to plot it out in time, would look like this sort of repeating pattern in time.
So one picture that's coming into my head, which is probably a very silly picture, but it's, you know, as you're speaking, and it's such a kind of simple picture that I know that it's not what you're talking about, but, you know, if you were pushing a child on a swing, say, and the child is going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, and it's just oscillating, well, you've just got a pendulum. Why isn't that, you know, really exciting and somehow breaking time symmetry because it's a repeating pattern? I mean, why?
Well, you are breaking time symmetry. You think of all clocks, and what do? They have a repeating pattern because you're counting cycles. That's what a clock is. You're counting cycles. But anything that's perfectly time symmetric, it wouldn't matter which way the clock ran, right? It would still work. So for instance, I have a clock in my basement that runs backwards. It's designed that way. It literally, the hands go the other way. And so they painted the numbers on backwards. It's still a clock. It's perfectly valid. It runs backwards, but it works as a clock.
Right.
It drives me nuts. To break time symmetry, though, so most real clocks break time symmetry because you've got to wind them, right? They don't run forever. You've got to put the batteries back in. You've got to wind them. They wear down. These things break time symmetry, but they don't break it in quite the same way as a crystal. What Wilczek was trying to get at was the idea of he was trying to imagine what a crystal would look like if instead of being regularly spaced in space, it was regularly spaced in time. At the atomic level. That's what Wilczek was kind of getting at.
Right. Okay.
Which is kind of an obscure kind of thing.
And so Wilczek proposed a way of making this, you said, by applying a magnetic field over some quantum particles, which would clump together and have some kind of perpetual oscillation, making them a time crystal.
It appeared a little bit like a perpetual motion machine. So there were a lot of people who were kind of not so keen on the idea. Patrick Bruno at the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility in France published an analysis of Wilczek's argument that said it had some problems. So Wilczek came up with a new idea and basically came up with this idea of a discrete time crystal where it's a little bit more modest. The particles in the system don't exist in a true state of equilibrium, which means that they wouldn't necessarily just go on repeating forever. So you don't get the perpetual motion problem necessarily.
So that was a few years ago. But since then, a couple of groups have made these time crystals, right?
Right. Chris Monroe at the University of Maryland, he led one of two experimental teams that actually created these time crystals. And what they discovered is that they have to have two particular properties if they're actually going to be real self-contained entities, right? So this is what makes them different from the clock on your wall. So one of the first things he discovered is that it's got to be rigid. And rigid in time, so rigid in space, means that it holds its shape, right? So that's rigid in space holds its shape. Well, rigid in time must hold its time shape, right? So the oscillation period has to remain exactly perfect, meaning it's got to be like a perfect clock.
Right. So in the discrete time crystal, the crystal doesn't oscillate perpetually without any external push. You need some kind of drive frequency. Is that right?
Right.
But to keep its rigidity, it means that if you change that drive frequency, the time crystal's oscillation shouldn't change to match the drive frequency. It should stay fixed.
Right, right. So the driving, you think about it this way. Here's a perfect analogy. If you're pushing someone on a swing and you push the same strength, right, you know that they're going to have a specific period of oscillation. This is the exact principle behind a pendulum clock, right? But instead of you pushing it, it's the gravity that is doing the pushing, right? That a pendulum clock works partly because of that, and partly because there's a spring. It's loaded with a spring, and the spring is the driver, really, right? So gravity keeps it going, but then the spring is the driver. And the idea is that the spring gives the same amount of force over and over and over again until you have to wind it again. And so that each tick of the clock is the same. Now, Chris Monroe discovered was that it would be like saying that the pendulum would have to keep the same exact period, regardless of how the spring was working. The spring could wear out, or it could change the force that it's acting, and it wouldn't change the pendulum. That's this idea of rigidity.
And that is very hard to imagine how that would work, how you would practically do that.
Yes, it's very, again, it's quantum. The second condition was that the system can't heat up, even though it requires energy to oscillate. Chris Monroe does a lot of work with trapped ions. And they took a dozen strongly interacting ytterbium ion spins. So they basically put the ytterbium ions set in a specific way with laser pulses so that its spin is pointing in a particular direction. And the laser pulses are what drove the system at a particular rate. And then you had additional laser beams added sort of a little randomness to each spin's rotation. That creates the disorder that prevented the system from heating up.
I see.
So it's kind of like every once in a while, if you're pushing somebody on the swing, every once in a while you push when they're not even there, right?
Right.
Right? So that's kind of the thing. So basically what they found was that the oscillation period of the spins remained at the fixed value. So they had the oscillation period of the spins set, even when they introduced the randomness, it remained at the fixed value. And it did so even when the pulse period changed slightly, which is exactly what I was saying. It's like you'd have to have the pendulum of the clock stay exactly in tune, regardless of how the spring was behaving.
It's rigid in time.
Yes, it's rigid in time. And there's a second experiment done by Mikhail Lukin at Harvard, which is a little bit less precise, but it's a little bit more of a natural setup. And he basically had nearly 1 million spins formed by impurities in diamond. They're called nitrogen vacancy centers. And the driving field in that case was microwave pulses. And the heat suppression kind of arose naturally from random variation in the dipole interaction between those vacancy centers. But again, it's the same basic idea.
Well, I think it sounds fantastic, but I'm just smiling because you sent this article about it from Physics World, and they've quoted this chap you mentioned, Patrick Bruno, who's not so excited about it, I guess. He says, for systems out of equilibrium, the spontaneous breaking of time translation invariance per se is neither new nor surprising nor mysterious. So,
I can see what his objection to it is. He wants them to find something that truly doesn't break the time symmetry, like Wilczek's original idea. I think it would be far more bizarre if we could create Wilczek's original experiment, because I don't think the universe really is time symmetric. I know a lot of people think that. Many of FQXI members, including my good friend Ken Wharton, absolutely believes that the universe is time symmetric. The laws of physics are mostly time symmetric, but they're not all time symmetric. And that's a mistake people make.
Ooh, okay. We're opening up something here that will take another 2 hours, I think, to discuss. But
yes. So my response to Bruno is, I actually think this is more interesting than what Bruno is looking at. He wants something that truly doesn't break the time symmetry, but I don't think we're going to find one, and I think it's interesting that we won't.
Right. Okay. Well, I guess just before we move on, I should say, I also have one of those clocks that ticks backwards.
Oh, do you?
Well, I guess the idea was to put it up opposite a mirror so that you could look in the mirror and see time going round in the right direction. But I never got round to doing that. And then it did just drive me mad because I got so good at reading that one, I started being unable to read other clocks properly. I tried to read those backwards and then I just was like, no, this is terrible because suddenly I'd be out in public and people would think I can't tell the time because I'd sort of be struggling for a moment looking at a clock trying to remember how to read it. And then I thought, no, that's not good. I'll take that clock down.
Well, Allison put it in the basement. And so every time I'm down in the basement, I look at the clock and I say, all right, now what time is it really? Think about it for a second, but anyway.
Right, so time. Time indeed. Time for number one.
Roll the drums. Number one, I said I knew it the moment it hit the news, and that is one of the recent discoveries by LIGO, which was the colliding neutron stars. And this came just after the Nobel Prize in Physics was given to the LIGO project. And it's the fourth ever detection event from LIGO.
That's LIGO, or the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, along with the French-Italian Virgo experiment, announcing the detection of gravitational waves that were generated when two neutron stars collided some 130 million light years away. This is the first ever observation on Earth of two neutron stars merging. Last year, of course, LIGO topped our list for the first ever detection of gravitational waves, that time, it was from the collision of two black holes. So, Ian, why is this result involving two neutron stars even more exciting, rather than just being another detection event?
This was a huge deal for a number of reasons. Certainly, LIGO getting off the ground and making its discovery was a big deal and deserved a Nobel Prize. This discovery really... it tells us a number of things about the universe, and it opens up a number of interesting avenues for exploration.
This is interesting, yeah, because I remember sort of last year when the LIGO thing came out, and obviously everyone was so excited, and there was all this sort of talk about how it could revolutionize the way that we look at the sky and get information. And now we seem to, you know, actually be seeing that, I guess.
Yes, there are a number of reasons why it's more than just a plain old discovery of gravitational waves. One of the first is that it solves the mystery behind short gamma ray bursts, which early in my career I worked on. And the short gamma ray bursts, turns out, it must be colliding neutron stars because of what this research shows. But some of the other things that this discovery showed is... this is great. They witnessed the creation of gold in the universe from this. So if you are looking for a get-rich-quick scheme, get your hands on a couple of neutron stars and collide, and you will have plenty of gold. I think one of the biggest things about this, so they now know exactly where it came from. The other LIGO discoveries, it was harder to pinpoint exactly where it came from, and the black hole mergers are hard to find because... you know, to follow up with an optical observation, it's like, well, LIGO doesn't pinpoint it that well. You point your optical telescope somewhere and you're looking around, well, you're not going to really see colliding black holes necessarily. You might get some X-ray stuff thrown off. But anyway, this discovery, they were able to verify optically, which is pretty amazing. Because up until LIGO came along, all of our observations in the universe were electromagnetic. When we look at anything in astronomy, it's all electromagnetic. We're either looking at X-rays or gamma rays or visible light or UV or infrared. And even when we're considering gravity, it's still electromagnetic because when we're looking at something or studying the gravity of something, we're studying how its light is reaching us, right? The only way we interact with these things at really great distances has up until now been via light. But LIGO opened up a whole new way of detection, right? A whole different spectrum. So like we have the whole spectrum of electromagnetic waves, we have a whole spectrum of gravitational waves. It's a totally different way of observing the universe. It opens up a totally new type of astronomy. And this detection, we were able to observe the same thing both through electromagnetic interactions and the gravitational. So we were able to pinpoint exactly where it was. We know exactly where the two neutrons were. And that's pretty amazing. I'd say that's the biggest aspect of this.
I mean, what's so amazing here is that we were talking about this time last year, after, you know, the gravitational waves from the merger of black holes had been announced. And obviously that was all over the news and we were very, very excited. And you were saying pretty much the same thing in terms of what potentially could be done in the future. And you were talking about, you know, this kind of multi-messenger astronomy that, you know, we've previously been looking at the electromagnetic spectrum. Now we can kind of combine that with, you know, looking at signals from gravitational waves and all of these kinds of things. And that was just a year ago. And then, boom, it happened. And it just kind of all paid off really, really fast. I mean, I don't know. I was almost sort of slightly disappointed that it happened so quickly. It sort of seems like, you know, nobody else got a look in this year, you know, being the number one story. Because as you say, as soon as this happened, it was like, oh, there they go again, you know.
I know.
They've got this one. And it is just so amazing, the speed of it. And people had said that as well. They'd sort of said at the time, you know, once you get the first one, once this kind of, you know, the threshold kind of opens and we're going to get all of these exciting results. But that's really fast. And, you know, kind of seeing all of this, it is amazing.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's going to revolutionize astronomy. And this is the first step in that. It also is important because it proves that neutron stars are powerful enough to create gravitational waves. Now, it certainly was predicted by the theory. And, you know, of course, one of the reasons this is great is because Einstein was right again. But the thing about it is that it was predicted that neutron stars could create gravitational waves, but they're considerably weaker than black holes. I mean, they're still pretty strong, but they're considerably weaker than black holes. And so the fact that we were able to identify gravitational waves from them is a pretty big deal. It also, by the way, gives us a direct measurement of the size of the universe, too, because it's kind of hard. Gravitational waves produce a characteristic sound that basically tells you how far away their source is. So it's a more accurate way of measuring the size of the universe. I just think that's so cool. And that's probably why it's going to lead to a lot of discoveries over the course of the next couple of years. I promise maybe next year something else will make the number one.
Oh, well, you know, it could combine, you know, this with my other favorite story. Could we use gravitational waves to look inside pyramids? I mean, that would be, you know,
that would be perfect.
That
would be perfect. I don't think it's possible, but you never know.
Throw in a time crystal, time traveling pyramids powered by gravitational waves, something like that.
And then throw in Doctor Who and everything's perfect.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. So there you have it. That's our list for 2017. Congratulations to the researchers behind the topological laser cavity, time crystals, and the detection of gravitational waves from colliding neutron stars. Thanks again to Ian Durham for selecting the items on this year's list. And thank you to you for listening. As always, you can read more about the selections on our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. And you can contact us by email at podcast@fqxi.org, on Twitter at fqxi, and on Facebook at fqxi physics. Wishing you all the best for 2018 from the team at FQXI. Please join us again in the new year when my regular co-host Brendan Foster will return. I've been Zia Morali.